ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Fuel prices can jump overnight, energy policy can shift fast, and the flow-on effects reach everything from households to the wider economy. I'm Carrington Clark, and on ABC Business Daily's Fuelcast, we bring you a quick update on what's happening in fuel, energy, and why it matters. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the ABC Business Daily team will bring you the latest in under 10 minutes. Find Fuelcast in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Peace talks failed, so now Donald Trump wants to disrupt the vital oil shipping route, the Strait of Hormuz, even further. A US blockade will stop ships entering or departing Iranian ports, but will it really work to bring an end to the conflict? Today, Hussein Abish from the Arab Gulf States Institute on what to expect and why this is becoming very much like a forever war. I'm Sam Hawley on Gadigal Land in Sydney. This is ABC News Daily.
Marathon peace talks between the US and Iran have failed to reach a breakthrough, raising fears of a reignited war. The historic face-to-face meeting ran more than 20 hours but ended in a deadlock.
J.D. Vance says he was in contact with President Donald Trump multiple times through the negotiations.
We've had a number of substantive discussions with the Iranians. That's the good news. The bad news is that we have not reached an agreement. And I think that's bad news for Iran much more than it's bad news for the United States of America.
Hussein, J.D. Vance, the vice president, he has largely been missing from this war. But over the weekend, he was the chief negotiator at these peace talks in Pakistan. Just tell me, why was that, do you think?
Well, I think there are two reasons. First of all, it gave the U.S.-Iranian face-to-face meetings in Islamabad a degree of gravitas that they otherwise wouldn't have had. In other words, this is notably the highest level diplomatic face-to-face meeting between a serving Iranian official, the Speaker of Parliament, Ghalibaf, who's effectively their leader at this point, I guess, or at least as far as anyone can tell, and a vice president of the United States since the 1979 revolution. Mm. The other reason is that Vance has been, in a quiet way, the most clearly dissident member of the Trump administration. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is he's certainly of the neo-isolationist wing of the MAGA movement, but also he cannot be fired uniquely. I mean, he's the only person around Trump who Trump cannot dismiss. He was elected independently as vice president. There's nothing Trump can do. He's stuck with him. So Vance, in a way, was kind of outmaneuvering Trump by making it clear that he wasn't for this unpopular war that a lot of people think has gone very badly and in many ways has. Trump, I think, returned the favor by saying, right, okay, it's your file now. Let's see what you can do. And now this way, if you have a big success, I'll be taking credit for it. And if you don't succeed, you'll be getting the blame.
All right, so Vance didn't want the war, and now he's actually tasked with ending it. But
exactly.
21 hours of talks, of course, he failed to reach a deal. He announced that himself. But Hussein, that's less than a full day. I mean, historically,
yeah,
peace talks take a bit longer, right?
Yeah, no one expected that they would be able to even come up with a bridging agreement to buy an additional few weeks. I mean, I think that was the optimistic scenario, but not in 24 hours. And these parties are very far apart from each other. They have both staked out maximalist demands. But I always thought that Trump was going to need to send the Iranians a stronger message that he is prepared to ratchet up pressure in a really meaningful military way.
Well, U.S. President Donald Trump says the U.S. Navy will immediately begin a blockade to stop ships from entering or leaving the Strait of Hormuz.
U.S. Central Command has confirmed the move, saying the blockade will be enforced impartially against vessels of all nations entering or departing Iranian ports and coastal areas, including all Iranian ports on the Arabian Gulf and Gulf of Oman.
As you know, at 10 o'clock tomorrow, we have a blockade going into effect. That'll be 10 o'clock tomorrow. Other nations are working so that Iran will not be able to sell oil.
And this business about blockading the Strait of Hormuz is something I've been wondering why the administration didn't try for weeks now. It seems such an obvious response, which is that the Iranians say, well, you know, if you're going to bomb us, your friends can't sell their oil, but our customers will still get theirs. That the American response can be, actually, no, you can't sell your oil either. And, you know, you need the Strait as much as anybody else for import and export. And, you know, let's see how much you like a blockaded Strait. Mm. So it's another interesting move here.
But how does Donald Trump achieve that, this threat to blockade the Strait of Hormuz altogether? Because Iran has said its response will be severe.
Yeah, well, what he can do, of course, is get a naval presence in the region, which interdicts shipping that they don't approve of. And that's exactly what Iran has threatened to do and has done in the past. And, you know, they can simply say, look, we're not allowing, we have this whole area under surveillance, we're not allowing anybody's shipping to pass until such time as Iran agrees to recognize that this is an open international shipping way for maritime commerce, open to all. And once we get that commitment from them again, as we had before the war, then we'll be glad to step back.
Mm, but Iran has been letting some ships through, right? Charging this.
Their own customers.
Right, but charging a massive, massive toll.
Yeah, if people are willing to pay, they've been willing to let them through. And also, if it's, you know, their own petroleum or oil bound for China and Japan and Korea and India, then yeah, go ahead. You're buying our oil. But that's not normal.
Mm, so you don't think the Iranians can stop this blockade?
I think they could try to run it or organize convoys. But no, I think the U.S. can probably do as much as the Iranians have done to spook shipping and transport and create the same kind of uncertainty that has impeded traffic for most shippers, you know, on the non-Iranian ledger. Mm. Now, the problem is, how long can the global marketplace endure this, mm. right? What is the economic ramification for the global markets? Iran does not care about the global markets. Washington does. Washington's very plugged in. Washington's allies and partners and trading partners are all very worried about this. Iran is the kind of outsider here. And so it's possible that the Iranians will calculate that they can survive a month of a blockaded port altogether more easily than the global economy. Mm. So it becomes another weird face-off.
Mm. Well, the threat of the blockade itself, of course, it did send oil prices surging again
sure.
to over $100 a barrel.
Of course.
So, yeah, as you say, the financial impact for the rest of the world could be very severe.
Yeah, it's the great weakness of the policy is that it may be more costly to the global economy than it is to the Iranian economy.
Well, Hussein, let's have a bit of a look at whether or not further talks could yield a better outcome. The US president said there is only one thing that matters. Iran is unwilling to give up its nuclear ambitions.
I think Iran is in very bad shape. I think they're very desperate. We had a meeting that lasted 21 hours. We understand the situation better than anybody. And Iran's in very bad shape. And just so you understand, Iran will not have a nuclear weapon. We'll not have. There is no way that they're going to get it. They still want it. And they made that clear the other night. Iran will not have a nuclear weapon.
If that is the ultimate aim, is that feasible? Is peace possible?
Well, look, here's what I think. Another thing that Donald Trump has probably convinced the Iranian government of is that they need to get hold of a nuclear weapon as soon as possible, because they will be contrasting their recent experience at the hands of the U.S. and Israel, plus that of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, plus that of Muammar Gaddafi's Libya, with the way in which Donald Trump and others treat North Korea, which has an independent nuclear deterrent and which does not get attacked like this. They are going to have to, I think, calculate that they need to focus on somehow figuring out in the next few years how to get to nuclear weapons status. And it is the American aim to absolutely prevent that. Mm. So you definitely have an absolute collision course. On the other hand, there are many conflicts that are not resolved. You can see how the current situation, the war as it's shaping up, is leading almost inexorably towards one of these open-ended stalemates where the larger power, you know, sort of ends the fighting, but reserves the right to come back and does on a routine basis every 6 months, 9 months, a year or so attacks again. The smaller power then retaliates in whatever way it can. And this happens repeatedly over time. It's the relationship the U.S. had with Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the 1990s. And that's exactly the kind of so-called forever war that Trump said he would never get into, but it really would bear all the hallmarks of that without actually necessitating boots on the ground.
All right. Well, Hussein, as we noted, Israel hasn't been part of these peace talks and it does continue to attack in Lebanon.
Israeli strikes continued on Sunday and Lebanon's health ministry said more than 2,000 people had been killed since the start of this latest war, including 165 children and more than
1 million people in Lebanon have been forced from their homes by Israel's bombing campaign. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's keeping his nation safe from Iranian-backed militia group Hezbollah.
I guess one question is, though, does Benjamin Netanyahu want the war to end? There was that reporting in the New York Times last week, right, that made it very clear that it was the Israeli leader who really convinced Donald Trump to go ahead with this war during that crucial Situation Room meeting. Mm-hmm. Remind me of that, and what insights did it give us? How important was that reporting?
The New York Times report, which was very well done, explained how and when Netanyahu and leaders of Mossad and other Israeli agencies kind of approached Trump and said, now's the time. Among other things, they promised him that the Iranian people would likely rebel against the clerical regime. And so based off of that and a whole bunch of fairy tales, the Israelis managed to persuade a particularly credulous American president that this was all a very good idea. And whatever the American president thought he was promised certainly didn't happen. So you have to be, I think, pretty ignorant and pretty dense to fall for it. But I think maybe the guy in the White House right now qualifies.
So does Benjamin Netanyahu want this war to end, do you think?
No, I don't think so. The one in Lebanon, he definitely doesn't want to end. Well, I think he's envisaging a conflict that goes on for months, if not years, and years, if not decades. So it's going to be hard to prevent him from getting his way unless he loses the coming Israeli election and there's a very different government with a different attitude, which is possible, or unless the United States starts changing its view of the Lebanese conflict. Now, one thing that did happen is that at first, the Israelis sold the Lebanese portion of this as a separate conflict, unrelated to the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran. And the Trump administration basically said, "All right, in which case you have a free rein here, just don't attack the airport and don't attack the port. And everything else, we leave it up to you." The Israeli response was to keep bombing Lebanon after the ceasefire began, and that led to this very tense early standoff. And now, apparently, the Israelis have promised Trump that they will lay off Lebanon for a little bit. We don't know how much, and we don't know for how long.
Well, Hussein, in your view, can a new peace agreement actually be reached before the ceasefire expires on April the 22nd, so in less than 10 days' time.
Oh, I think it's extremely unlikely, to say the least. I think the most optimistic scenario would be some arrangement whereby more time is bought. And I think otherwise, we will have either emerging by default a stalemated conflict that becomes a grass-mowing exercise, or a series of ineffective short-term agreements that produce the same result. I think that's not in anybody's interests, and particularly not in the interests of Iran's neighbors, the Gulf Arab countries. For them, it's a security nightmare par excellence, because they expect to be hit more than anybody else, and they fully expect to be the targets of choice again and again and again.
Hussein Abish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute. This episode was produced by Sydney Peed. Audio production by Cinnamon Nippard. Our supervising producer is David Cody. I'm Sam Hawley. To get in touch with the team, email us on ABC News Daily at abc.net.au. Thanks for listening.